There we go. If you have a cell phone, please don't use it in this room, unless you want to tape the talk. That's totally fine. Please don't tape the shares afterwards, but you can tape anything I say and hold it against me in a court of law, in a Dharma court of some sort. You can. But if you have to make any text or anything like that, feel free to use the room in the back and hang your head in shame as you leave. Okay, so tonight's talk is on money. Money. Next week I'll have to give a talk on sex. Might as well. What after that? That's
I'll
it, right?
As I go along.
That's pretty much it. Money, sex. No, there'll be other topics after that, but what I don't know. The Buddha left Kapalivatsu, the castle of the Shakyans, when he was 28 and decided that the riches and splendors that he had was surrounded with as a rich young guy was too distracting for him to find a source of inner peace that would be of use when he was confronted with the inevitable sufferings that we all must face, not just the aging, sickness, and death, but as well all of the setbacks and the griefs, the separations, the frustrations, all of the stuff that comprises the first noble truth, the inevitable dukkha of life, the suffering that is inherent in existence, which is basically along with the good news and the fun experiences, there's also a lot of difficulties. And so, at first, the Buddha tried to find a solution amidst great deprivation. He starved himself to within an inch of his life. He ate only a small fraction of a cup of rice each day. He tried to find a sense of peace, inner peace, a dharma that was completely at odds with any sense of comfort or ease. And that didn't work either. He found himself so tired, so sick, so ill at ease in his distress that he couldn't develop much peace at all. And so eventually the solution came with the so-called middle path, which was based on the recognition that even the most stringent renunciate needs four requisites. The four requisites being every human needs food, clothing, shelter, and medicine, the Buddha said, just to form a foundation for spiritual practice. Now, renunciates, or monks, or nuns, they deal with most of the suffering that happens in life in very skillful ways. They meditate for hours a day. They do an enormous amount of engaged practice, which puts them in touch with the surrounding community. They do a lot of projects with other renunciates. They do a lot of teaching. So these types of actions go a long way to addressing the root of our core suffering, which is often from the feelings of being alone, unique, separate, cut off, different from other people, the belief that our thoughts are somehow very special, that we are isolated, that no one knows how we feel. The work that the monks, nuns, renunciates do puts them in constant contact with others based on a very honest and open form of dialogue. And they have a feel-good quality of so much of their lives is giving back and being a part of something larger than themselves. So in the West, as lay practitioners, we tend to need a lot more requisites than just those, the bare minimum of, you know, a couple of robes and a food bowl. And in the West, in capitalism, and in most countries, not just in the West, the way we deal with stress and suffering is not directly addressing the core. We actually divert ourselves from the feelings of discomfort and stress. We use these very powerful band-aids that cover up that basically for a short period of time make the unease go away. We do this with things that either soothe and chill us out or excite us. That's basically it. Soothing and exciting. Thrill or chill. That's what all drugs boil down to. That's what all of the diversions we do boil down to. Chilling ourselves out with beer after work, or cramming carbs, which release serotonin, which basically are neural inhibitors. Beer is loaded with gabaminobutric acid, which you knew, and that shuts down the frontal lobe. Heroin does too. But we also... We also like to divert our awareness of our inner feelings of separation and loneliness and fear about the future. We like to sledgehammer it away with stuff that presents a lot of dopamine in the brain, which feels terrific. Dopamine and endorphins, opiates feel lovely. And that, one of the most powerful inducers of that is shopping. Purchasing, success and approval from others, especially in creative and work endeavors. So money becomes very much entwined with the way we remove or address our inevitable stresses and discomfort, which arise all the time. So we tend to use short-term solutions because dopamine and endorphins only last for a little while. The gleam of an eye gadget, the smell of a new book, the texture of a new shoe only lasts as a reward, as a diversion, as a distraction for a little while. And then we are back in those thoughts of, what's going to happen to me? What do people think about me? Why am I different? Why do I feel different? Why do I have these thoughts? Why am I anxious? All this stuff returns. So rather than addressing the roots, as spiritual practitioners who are engaged in practice full-time do, we tend to not address the roots unless we have a rich meditation practice or therapy or some form of other practice that goes down and looks at the core reasons why we feel separate and unique, and begins to relieve that feeling. So, additionally, there's obviously a breakdown in the level of care that we give to each other. In America, there's almost 3 times the likelihood that people will spend their dwindling years in a nursing home than any European country, and about 5 times that of Asia. So most of us are aware there's a good chance that when we reach a stage in life when we're incapacitated, or we won't have somebody taking care of us, that we, you know, basically there's a feeling that we have to buffet ourselves with money to prepare for the future. We have unaffordable health care, so there's a sense that any injury or physical disease or anything of that nature could render us bankrupt. So the very feeling of being secure in capitalism is secured by accumulating money. So if money is not just about relieving stress on a daily level, it's also about the great sense of insecurity that we have about the future. And it's amazing. I read this statistic that the average American disposes of a phone every 14 months, even though the average phone will last 5 or 6 years in use. The average, we get rid of computers, laptops, every 3 years, despite the fact they last 2 times that length. Our cars are disposed in about a third of the time that their actual lifespan is. So we basically don't buy things by need or by how long they are useful. We buy for other reasons. There's a great French sociologist named Pierre Bourdieu, although he might be Belgian, I'm not really sure. But Bourdieu did this huge, thick book called Distinction, which basically studied all of the ways people spend money. And what he determined was that we don't buy things because of their aesthetics. We buy things because we want to establish ourselves in a class in relationship to other people. Everything we buy is a sort of emblem that says who we are. It gives us an identity. It's a statement to the world of how we view ourselves in relation to others. So, money is not just relieving stress. It's not just buying off our fear of what's going to happen to us in the future. It's even something that provides us with a sense of stability, a sense of identity, a sense of belonging to some group or some section or some class. And so, when we look at this, it's no wonder that so much of our lives as Westerners, there's no sense of what is enough. None of us really know what's enough. When do I have enough? Because when we add all these fears and additional agendas, it becomes so abstract. We have no feeling or understanding of what is enough to survive, and it becomes almost sometimes competitive, where we're aware of how, in New York, how much money is being made around us by others. And there's a feeling that of insufficiency. You related to that one time. So. Spiritual practice. The Buddha said that we pretty much have to look at money in a completely different way. not in terms of comparing ourselves with others or trying to provide ourselves with a security against unknowables or trying to establish any lasting identity or even as a way to relieve ourselves of a bad day, the stresses from an insult at work, the feelings of not getting anything done, or the fears and the worries or the frustrations of a interaction that have gone awry. All of these temptations are very understandable, but they lead to this spiraling. And when we give into the temptation to purchase our way out of anxiety, what happens is dopamine creates a feedback spiral that is never satisfiable. Dopamine lasts for a little while, and then it goes away, and then it creates a feeling of even greater anxiety. Just the lack of dopamine from the rush gives us a sense of anxiety, not to mention all the other anxieties I just mentioned. And so to relieve that anxiety, we have to acquire, consume, buy more. And all of this consumption and this acquiring is actually taking a toll, not just on the earth, where we use I think we use more electricity than all of Russia, China, and India combined. Which is, or I think the same amount. And that's like they have 12 times the population or 14 times the population. So it creates a feedback loop. And nothing is ever enough. As the Buddha said in his the summary of the Dharma at one point, he said, the world is swept away. It does not endure. It is not sufficient to fill our craving. Because the loop of getting, acquiring, consuming, the moment that rush goes away, we're back in that feeling of I'm not enough. I don't have enough. I'm vulnerable. Something's missing from my life. I need more. So the spiritual answer is to go back again to this whole area of asking ourselves, instead of trying to fill these unknowables, just ask ourselves, what do I need to be able to practice and engage meaningfully in my life? What are the bare amounts that I need? Instead of viewing money or capital as the solution, it becomes simply a means to an end. When the Buddha was teaching, there was a wealthy guy named Anathapindika, and none of these fucking names are fucking easy. So I'm going to quote a couple of them, and they're just a pain in the fucking ass. But here we go. To Anathapindika, he says, the purpose of your money is it can be good if you use it to make sure that you and your family are just comfortable enough and that your friends don't have to worry about you, that it teaches you how to live up to your obligations and responsibilities in the world, and especially that you support people in needs. And the Buddha was being, you know, he always gave a little bit of a pitch, you know. Hey. Now, to Vajapaja. Vajapaja, pudding and pie. I don't know what his name was. Vajapaja. Vajghapajja. He said, accumulate wealth honestly. Don't compartmentalize, which means if you're ashamed of the way you make money, that's going to create stress and it's going to become difficult to practice. He said, to pay one's obligations to the king, but not excessively, which means pay your taxes, but don't pay more than you need, because he viewed kings as little better than robbers. He used them in the same sentence. And then he said, secure your what money you have securely having just enough to practice so that you don't lose it and you create stress. So the core of the Buddha's teachings on, when we give talks about work in spiritual practice, people tend to focus on, you know, what kind of work we shouldn't have. The Buddha talked about don't engage in slave trading, and I hope none of you are doing that. don't sell arms or poisons and stuff like that. We get caught up in that. But the real core of his teaching about right livelihood is don't engage in your career trying to have it be the thing that establishes your identity, your sense of self-worth, your sense of peace, because it won't do that. It's too dependent on other people. It's too subject to changes beyond your control. If you have a spiritual practice, that can address, that can do the heavy lifting of giving you ease, giving you a sense of, your spiritual community can give you a sense of connectedness. And work can be a wonderful way to, you feel good about it because it's allowing us to develop the means for our, the rest of our lives. And that takes so much of the pressure off. Because it's not establishing our worth. It's not establishing our identity. It's simply a lovely means that we can be really good at and enjoy. But knowing that when it comes to the hard work of what are we going to do when we face aging and sickness and death and loneliness and separation, that's not going to be answered by most people's careers. That's going to be answered by the deep, rich spiritual connections and the deep inner work that we do in our practice. Another element that's really important to note is the Buddha talked constantly about being mindful of one's money, but not attached to it. Now, what the fuck does that mean, right? Basically, what it means is mindfulness means we know what's present. We have a sense of how much we have, how much we're spending, whether it leaves us with enough so that we can be just comfortable enough so that we can be healthy and happy and have practice in our lives. But on the other hand, when we attach to it is when we want it to do something more than what it's capable of doing. When we obsessively watch the markets, if we're lucky enough to have money in the markets, I would hate that because I don't know what the fuck any of that is about. But some people like that, you know, and they're, this went up and that went down, and you know, if we're like that, then our happiness is contingent upon something we have no control over. Again, markets go up, down, money appears, disappears, for reasons nobody fucking knows. I mean, even those financial gurus in 2008 were, what the fuck is happening? At which point all of us came to the rescue without our permission every So when we're aware, when we're mindful, we're not in that kind of haze where we don't want to open that bill, we don't want to look at that account, that's creates suffering. That kind of thing, when we don't look, creates that feeling of unease. And it's obviously better to address straightforwardly, look and know, so that we can at least begin to address issues. But when we attach is when we want money to do more than it's supposed to do. In essence, I don't And I don't pretend to know what is enough for anyone else other than myself. It's an ongoing balance. I have to, my needs and the needs of a friend who's got two children, or the needs of a friend who's got elderly parents are taken care of, are completely different. I do know that just like work, the goal is for me to have a relationship with money that doesn't create so much stress, so much diversion, so much anxiety, that it causes me additional suffering and discomfort in my life. I want to just have enough so that today I can practice. I don't personally know what's enough for some untold future, and frankly, my best plan is to move Thailand. Where I saw a lot of really fucking old people who had no money living very comfortably. So, and that's fine by me, because I'm happy. You know, and I don't sit there trying to get the idea that somehow an unknowable future can be solved by stockpiling money. I don't have the idea that that it can establish any sense of purpose or any sense of feeling good or being of value in the world. I don't believe that it can establish any sense of security at all. It just allows me what I need enough to have the things that do bring me security, which is my friends, my support group, my practice, my study, my dharma, my engaged work, all of the wonderful emails that people send that I correspond with. All of that stuff is what makes me feel secure. And nothing that I'll ever have in any account will ever do that. So this at least gives me a much more realistic sense. I now, at this point in my life, never feel that I don't have enough, because I'm asking so much less of it. So I hope there's something worth thinking about in there. I'm going to turn off the tape.